भद्रं कर्णे धिष्णुयाम देवाः भद्रं पश्ये माक्षभिर्यचत्राः स्थिरैरङ्गैस्तुष्टुवागुंसस्तनूभिः व्यशेम देवहितं यदायुः स्वस्ति न इन्द्रो वृत्तश्रवाः स्वस्ति नः पूषा विश्ववेदाः स्वस्ति नस्तार्क्षो अरिष्टनेमिः स्वस्ति नो बृहस्पतिर्दधातु ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः। I'll just quickly review verse 15, so we'll chant that one and then we'll go on to 16. So repeat after me. Anyatha grinata swatnaha, nidrata twamajanataha, nidrata twamajanataha, viparyase tayokshine, viparyase tayokshine, turiyam padamashnite, turiyam padamashnite, anyatha grinataha. Swapnaha Nidra Tattvam Ajanataha Viparayase Tayoho Kshine Turiyam Padam Ashnate. Remember, for the Vishwa Tajasa, the Vishwa and Tajasa, both of them have the Anyata Grahanam. Right? There's these two terms, Anyata Grahanam and Agrahanam, Tattva Agrahanam. So the Nidra, or the prajna, the deep sleep state, is nidra. That's the deep sleep. It has tattva agrahanam. Means in deep sleep, there's no anyata agrahanam. There's no perception of something other than in a way that it is not. Something unreal, for instance. There's no perception of duality. In the deep sleep, there's only the tattva agrahanam, the non-perception of reality, of the truth. And so, but in the Vishwa and Tejasa, there's both the tattva agrahanam, the non-perception of reality, and therefore the misperception, the misapprehension, right, of what is. So the anyata means in a different way. So that there's a perception of what is in something as something other than what it is. That's the anyata agrahanam. And so both the swapna, the dream state, and the waking state are lumped together as swapna, right? Because both in the waking state and the dream state, both are equally mitya. The projection is equally mitya. So it's not like the waking state is any more real than the dream state. So they put these both as swapna. So in this verse it says, swapna means dream, for the one who is perceiving, who is seeing things other than how they really are, right? Anyata grahanam, that is swapna. This dream state, swapna, is, so swapna includes both the waking state and the dream. It's for the one who is perceiving reality as other than what it is. And nidra, the deep sleep, is for the one who is just tattvam ajanataha, for the one who's not knowing the truth. And so here it says, viparyase tayoho kshine, when both of these errors, right, when there is a removal, when the errors of both of these are removed, both the swapna, the swapna, which stands for Vishwa in Tejasa, and the deep sleep, the nidra, that stands for the prajna, when both types of errors are removed, it is then the turiyam padam ashnate, one attains this fourth pada, which is called turiya, the fourth. So there's something, we'll see it more here in this next verse, but there's something really important to understand here, what is actually being pointed out. It is the removal of the error for the deep sleep state. When they say the error for both of them, but even in the deep sleep state, there's an error, even though it's the non-perception of duality. Because when you wake up from the waking state, from that state, you say, you know, I slept last night. That means from your standpoint, you, the Atma, goes to sleep. And so that's an error. Atma never goes to sleep. It doesn't go through different states of experience. So if I say, oh, I slept well last night, or oh, I had a dream, you know, or now I'm here in this world, you know, relating in this world. In all of those situations, there's an error where the ahankara is identifying itself, the I, that the I notion is identifying with something other than what I am. And so even in the deep sleep, even though you say at that time, there's no experience of duality and there's no mistake really being committed, right? Because there's no, the one who commits the mistake is in unmanifest condition. So there's just the total non-perception of reality. There's no projection at all. But when you wake up and you're talking about that state, then you're saying, I went to sleep. I had a great sleep last night. So that is the error that we make in terms of deep sleep. I dreamt. I am the waker. I am the seer. I am the one who is engaged in whatever I'm engaged in. There's this total identification with the jiva. And so what it says here is it's only when these errors are eliminated that one attains the fourth pada. Now what's important here is that when we think about gaining knowledge of anything, right? The antakarana, my mind, using my sense organs or the means of knowledge I have to gain an antakarana vritti, what we call a jnana vritti, a thought modification which is true to the object, right? Which then I illumine, which then I know. And then in that way, I remove ajnanam, I remove ignorance. Okay, I'm going to do a little aside here on this because this is the whole, this is such an important thing. We say, and this will be moving us into the next verse also, but that's okay. When we talk about Maya from the standpoint, we say Maya itself, just in general, Maya itself has two shaktis, two capacities. One capacity it has is the what we call the one capacity it has is what we call avarana. It has the capacity to cover. And it also has the capacity to project. Okay? So two things. It'll cover, like for instance, it covers the rope, and in covering the rope, it allows for the projection of the snake. So these are called two shaktis, two capacities, avarana and vikshepa. Now, from the standpoint, so this is Maya, it has these twofold capacities. From the standpoint of Ishwara, the avarana is not in play. From the standpoint of Ishwara, there's only vikshepa. What that means is that the maya, from the standpoint of Ishwara, when we're talking about the whole Ishwara upadi, the whole maya, when maya comes into manifestation as Ishwara, really as Hiranyagarbha and then Ishwara, there is only projection. From the standpoint of Ishwara, there's nothing being covered because there is no limitation. Right? There's a huge difference here. If you think, if you look at the whole Maya Upadi being projected, that Maya Upadi has running through it sattva, rajas, and tamas. Sattva is that which allows for the manifestation of consciousness. We have to use different words for this. It's all kind of difficult. But just to try to understand, when the whole Maya Upadi projects, and we're looking from the standpoint of the whole, the identification with the whole, there is no limitation. There's no antakarana. There's no mind that is a limited entity within the whole manifestation. So in that case, when that's the case, we say there is just manifest knowledge, infinite manifest knowledge. This is the case for Ishwara. This is the case, I use this as an example for you in the dream, like if you have a dream and you're not identified with any object in the dream, then you just have the manifest knowledge, right? Without any limitation in reference to that particular, in reference to that dream reality, there's no limitation. your identification is just with the projection itself, right? And so that's what we would call limit from Ishwara's standpoint. That is limitless knowledge. So the whole creation from Ishwara's standpoint is just the vikshepa, the projection of Maya. So there's Brahman with Maya, you know. The Maya projects, and then that projection, whatever it is, that is known. That's why we say Ishwara is infinite knowledge. You see what I mean? So from that standpoint, the Maya, there's only projection, there's only vikshepa. But if you go into all of the different jivas within the projection, put it another way, all of the antikaranas, all of the minds within the projection, those minds have a different situation. They are part of the total projection, but from their own standpoint, right, there are an infinite number of those minds. And since there is more than one, each mind is limited. So the experience that you have is different from the experience that you have, different from the experience that I have. And for each mind within the total projection, that mind suffers from the twofold capacity of Maya, the capacity to cover and the capacity to project. It suffers from this capacity, the Maya's capacity to cover, because that mind only that mind has a jnanam in reference to any given object, and even reference to the nature of your own self, which I'll talk about that in a minute, unless using a means of knowledge, it lands upon the object that is to be known. Like, for instance, in order for me, my mind, you know, which enjoys consciousness, you know, sattva, for my mind to gain knowledge of the painting, for instance, I have to utilize a means of knowledge in order to gain a vritti of the painting, and the thought modification of the painting once gained, then that painting is known. See what I mean? If I don't gain the thought modification of the painting, then I have ignorance in reference to the painting. And so for a jiva to gain knowledge, your antakarana has to land on the object, or it has a jnanam of the object. It's ignorant of the object. It has ignorance of the object. And so you can think, sometimes Swamiji will use the example of, you think of your mind as a flashlight that's going around like this, or where it lands, right, then that object is lit up and the ajnanam in reference to that object is removed. But unless your mind lands on that, right, there is no knowledge of it. Okay? So in our situation, what we're as jivas, we're suffering just by the very nature of the upadhi, right? Which is all maya. But the antakarana upadhi is suffering from limitation. It's not a manifestation of absolute knowledge. And so your mind has to gain knowledge. If it doesn't gain knowledge, it has ajnanam. And so then we go around collecting knowledge. That's what we do. We go around studying and learning and looking, using our pramanas to gain knowledge of the world. And the areas where we haven't been able to use a pramana, a means of knowledge, in those areas we're ignorant. And we go on collecting our knowledge, okay? So now, what we're used to doing here is just that. Using our mind through our means of knowledge to objectify something, right? Using our means to objectify something, and when we objectify something, then that thing is known. There's another situation that we have going on here, though. And that is, in reference to knowledge of myself, right? In reference to knowledge of myself, it's a different situation, because in this situation, I am already here. And so that myself is already present. And so it's no longer a question now of having to objectify an object so that I can have an experience of it. See what I mean? For all other things, I need to objectify the object so that I can have an experience of it. And that's how I know it. But I'm already here. And so there's no question of objectifying me. I'm already the one because of whom all objects are known. I'm the conscious being that illumines all of the antakarana vrittis, all of the thought modifications that are given to me through the use of my means of knowledge. All of those things are already illumined by me. I am ultimately the luminary, the conscious being. And so I am present. I am self-evident. But now the problem is that this self-evident me also is unknown, only partially though. I am already known as a self-evident conscious being. I am, I exist, I'm a conscious being. Nobody has to tell me that. I don't need a pramana to verify that I'm a conscious being, that I exist. That's kind of the bottom line of my being. So that isn't the problem. That's not where the ignorance lies. That's already self-evident, the self-evident me. So the problem here is not in gaining an experience of me. The problem is removing the error, removing the ajnanam, the ignorance that has caused my mind to take the self-evident me as itself, or as the waker, as the dreamer, as the deep sleeper. So that the problem is now going to be removing the ajnanam, kind of removing this tattva agrahanam, where I am my own experience, but I don't understand what it is. And since I have my own self-experience, I'm self-evident, but I am confused. My mind doesn't recognize me as the adhishtana, as the very being that it enjoys. The mind takes me to belong to it. So the problem here is not gaining knowledge of me. It is in removing the ignorance of me, which will remove the mistake. Right? So here what he's saying is, when the error has been removed, then the pada, the turiya pada, is attained. It's why this is so important, is because in gaining self-knowledge, it's not the gain of a new experience. It's the removal from the self-experience, the self-evident experience that I have that is already me. I already have it as me. It's simply removing the projections by recognizing my own nature, viveka, discriminating me from all of these things that my mind has superimposed me upon. You see the difference? That's why, we were talking the other day, I guess in the Drishya, you know, it's really, the recognition of yourself is the gaining self-knowledge is recognizing that the self that you've always taken to be you is free. If that's so, then there's no attainment of a new self or a new self-experience. There's simply the removal from your own self-identity of this baggage of these things that have been superimposed upon it. And so that's why the experience is such an incredible experience. It's when you understand, that understanding, that kind of enlightenment or that awakening, that waking up, as they're going to use this term, to actually wake up, it's kind of like you just saying, I am free. I, this one that is me, that I've always taken to be me, this me that has always been me, that I've always recognized as me, nobody else, it is this very me that is free. And so this is not a new experience. It's simply a removal of the misidentifications. And you recognize that you are free, and you have always been free, and you always will be free. But there's no new experience. So here, when he says this, the air of these two states, the swapna, which includes the visual and tajasa, and then the deep sleep, right? When the air of these two is removed, then that pada, that fourth pada, is gained. So all that's saying is it's a gain of the gain. So we say this, we always use this term, knowledge or self-knowledge or moksha is praptasya praptihi. It's the attainment of the attained. It's the gain of the gained. You know, there's no new gain. There's a removal of ignorance. In fact, when we talk about knowledge in terms of gaining self-knowledge, we say ajnana nivritti. It's not the gain of a knowledge. It's the removal of ignorance. Right? Whereas we're not used to that. What we're used to is having the mind gain an experience which was not previously there. Right? So you're gaining a new experience. And now this new experience is known. For instance, they use example. If somebody walks into the room that you've never seen before, you are now having a new experience. Right? This person that you didn't even know existed before, it's called anadi, it's beginningless ajnanam. This person who's never existed, you didn't even know about them at all. Right? Now you become aware of them. This is a new experience. Right? You'll never have a new experience of yourself because you're already there. And so the ajnanam is not bringing in a new self. Oh, look, that's me. That's not the experience at all. It's the recognition of the me that you have always recognized as you minus the superimposition. See the difference? It's a huge difference. Now, when we're talking about this ajnanam or ajnana nivritti, the removal of this ajnanam, then we have to look at ajnanam or amaya itself. When does ajnana even begin? When does ignorance begin? So that's what this, let's do this next verse and then we'll get into it a little more. Anadimayaya suttaha. Anadimayaya suttaha. Yada jiva prabhujyate. Yada jiva prabhujyate. Ajam anidrama swapnam. Ajam anidrama swapnam. Advaitam bhujyate tada. Advaitam bhujyate tada. Anadi mayaya suttaha. Yada jivaha prabhujyate. Ajam anidram aswapnam advaitam bhujyate tada. He says, yada jivaha. When the jiva, jiva has the nominative singular, yada means when. Yada jivaha, when the jiva, suttaha. Who is asleep? Suttaha. Anadi mayaya. Due to beginningless, anadi means beginningless maya. So when the jiva, who is asleep, due to anadi mayaya, due to beginningless maya, when that jiva prabhujyate wakes up, tada then, what is known? Ajam, that one who is ajam, birthless, free of birth, who is anidram, free of sleep, deep sleep, aswapnam, free of dream, advaitam, one without a second, buddhyate, is known, tada then. So it says, when the jiva, who is asleep due to beginningless maya, prabhujyate, wakes up, then, tada, then, the one who is ajam, free of birth, anidram, free of deep sleep, aswapnam, free of dream, advaitam, one without a second, that one, the turiya, it's the turiya, the fourth pada, that one is known. Okay. See, the question can come up like, when did the problem begin for the jiva? Yeah. Did the jiva ever know? Was there ever a prior condition of knowledge? You know? And then the jiva fell into, the individual fell into this ignorance, into this self-forgetfulness. What caused the jiva to fall into self-forgetfulness like this? To not know themselves? What happened? Why did they fall into, why did you fall into this state? What happened to you? So this is accepting the mistake that you have made. You've made this mistake, and now here you are scrambling around as a samsari, drowning in ajnanam, because somehow you had taken a dive into the deep sea of ajnanam. But actually, when we think about ajnanam and maya, so maya itself, there is no ajnanam apart from maya. Right? It's just you have to look. It's like for the jiva, what is maya for Ishvara is ajnanam for the jiva. Right? That's what I was trying to make you see. Like if there's no limitation, if there's no limitation to the manifest, infinite manifest knowledge, just infinite sattva, there is no ajnanam. There is nothing unknown. But if you have an antakarana within that manifest creation, ajnanam, what is maya to Ishvara, is ajnanam, subject to ajnanam for the jiva, because of the limitation of the antakarana. And so for that antakarana, for that sattva, antakarana, to have knowledge, right, it needs a pramana. It needs a pramana in order to land upon something, so that that antakarana is filled with some sort of objectification. Do you understand what I mean like that? Okay, so if the antakarana is not functioning, or there's no pramana functioning, that antakarana is suffering from knowledge, from ajnanam. Now, the question is, when did that ajnanam begin? So if we look at even maya, let's go back to maya. This is needs a little bit more unfoldment, but I'm just going to throw it out there for now and unfold a little bit, and we'll keep working on it. If we look at Brahman, just the Satchitananda, the conscious being, the reality, Brahman. Brahman itself is this, not even beginningless. You can't even say Brahman is beginningless. You say Brahman is free of time. So beginningless is already out the window. If something has no time, there's no past, present, or future, there is just presence. Timeless, changeless presence. And that timeless, changeless sat, this pure sat, is what is. That is satyam. That is the reality. Just pure sat chit. Sat, which is chit. So Brahman, we don't say, is beginningless. We say it is timeless. Maya, when we're talking about maya, and we break down what maya is and its order of reality, we say maya, yama iti maya. That which is not, that is maya. Means that which depends totally on it for its being upon Brahman. That is maya. What is responsible for the whole manifestation of all duality? That is maya. Where do we place maya? Where does it exist? It has no being apart from Brahman. So you have to say, you can't even say with maya, you can't categorize maya as something which exists apart from Brahman, nor can you say it exists in Brahman as some sort of secondary entity, because maya is mithya. It depends totally for its being on Brahman. And so therefore we would say, you can't categorize it as satyam, as something that is real or something that is non-existent. You just have to say maya is all of this manifest duality that has no independent being apart from Brahman. And so in a sense, maya is not, only Brahman is. But because we experience it here, we say that it is. But where are you going to... So what we have to say is, okay, Maya, when you analyze it, you find that it has no being of its own, it's mitya. And so then if you want to say, well, where did Maya come from? Did Brahman build Maya? Did Brahman create Maya? Well, Brahman doesn't have any hands or legs. Brahman doesn't have any duality to create Maya. So did Maya create itself? Well, how can Maya create itself? It has to already be there to be able to create itself. It can't create itself out of nothing. Brahman can't create it. And so we say Maya itself, acknowledging that it is here, we say Maya itself is beginningless. Right? Because Brahman is timeless. Maya can't have, has no being apart from Brahman. And if Maya has no being apart from Brahman, and Brahman is timeless, we say Maya itself is beginningless. We don't say timeless, because Maya comes into manifestation and goes out of manifestation. It's cyclical. The projection of Maya is cyclical. So because time and space take place within Maya, we say Maya is beginningless. Here we are experiencing Maya. We're experiencing cause-effect, interconnectedness, continual coming and going, continual change. When did this Maya start? Well, when did Brahman start? Brahman never started. Brahman is timeless. Did Brahman create Maya? No. Brahman doesn't have any hands or legs to create anything. Brahman has no duality. So what brought Maya into being? We have to say Maya itself is intrinsic to Brahman. But when you say it's intrinsic to Brahman, you can't think that it's something different than Brahman or other than Brahman or adds to Brahman or subtracts from Brahman. Just like the clay pot, the pot doesn't add anything to Brahman. It doesn't take to the clay. It doesn't take away anything from the clay. It is only clay. But then there's a pot. So there's a pot which is nothing but clay. So we say there's Maya. Maya is nothing but Brahman. But I say Maya that is nothing but Brahman, but Maya is not a synonym for Brahman. See what I mean? If I say the pot is nothing but the clay, but pot is not a synonym for clay. That's Maya. That's what we mean by mitya. There is this thing here that has no being, no substance whatsoever, apart from the adhishtana, which in this case is Brahman. So this Maya has no beginning. It's anadi. You can't give a beginning to it because there's no one to create it. So we say Maya is always here. But then if you go into, well, what is it that's actually here? Well, it's this Maya that we experience that upon analysis is nothing but Brahman. You understand what I mean? So you can say it's a paradox. It's not really a paradox. Because when you go into analysis of the creation that you experience, what you end up with is only satchit. Everything that you experience comes into being and goes out of being. It doesn't have any being of its own. Being is the only thing that never comes into being and goes out of being. And so you can have immediate, direct recognition of this fact. But to do that, for you to recognize this, let me put it this way. This is the experiential reality that is here right now. But for you as a jiva, with a body, mind, sense organs, to wake up to this, right? You have to wake up to this, means that there's a viveka that has to take place. That is, they use the example of, you know, the humsa bird who's sucking milk out of a water. If you put half water and half milk, the humsa bird comes and sucks out the milk, leaving the water. That's what has to be done here. Because here, in your perception of this room, for instance, there is the Maya, this display of nama rupa, of name and form, of seer, seeing, seen, right? If you look at it in one way, there's a display of color. There's a display of dimension. There's subject-object. There's seer seeing. So if we analyze our experience in this room, you're going to, in your analysis, you will notice that you, the jiva, this body, mind, sense organs, are the subject. And through your sense organs and mind, you are experiencing the world of objects. Subject, object, knower, knowing, and known. It's called the jnatra, the knower, the jnanam, the knowing, and then the prameya, the thing to be known. The pramatra, the pramatra, the knower, the pramana, the means of knowledge, the prameya, the thing that is being known. That's how we divide up our experience. And so as I'm walking around in this room, I am always the subject. As you're walking around, you are always the subject. Because all of your experiences are pouring in through your pramanas, through your means of knowledge, forming an antakarana vritti, a thought modification, which is known. Known to you, the conscious being. Right? And so you are always the subject, and everything else is the object. And so, that being so, it's easy for me to stop there where I'm just the subject, this is the object. And so what has to happen, there has to be a whole shift, a whole different type of recognition that involves this, that while you, it is true that now at this moment, your identification is with you as the subject, we have to shift the perspective so that you recognize that, all right, this room I'm perceiving through my sense organs, that's a fact. And so this whole room is, you know, it enjoys isness, it all is, and it all is known. That's the sat-chit. But I am the subject. All this is, without any doubt, I mean, the whole thing enjoys being, and the whole thing enjoys consciousness in the form of it is all known. Now what we have to do, though, is we have to put everything else into the room that is known. You have to realize, yes, and through these sense organs, not only is this room known, enjoying the sat-chit, this body is known. And so the body also, being known through my sense organs, is also bathed equally by sat-chit. It is and it is known. And then I have to go another step. I have to realize, yes, and in fact, my sense organs, so you just start including everything into the sat-chit. My sense organs themselves, they are, and they are known. Right? I'm aware of them. So that also gets thrown into the world, this objectified world. Then I have to realize that, well, in fact, the mind, my mind also is known. It is and it is known. So now everything is getting more and more objectified. And I say even the ahankar, the I notion, even that is known. And so now as I do that, as I kind of do this exercise, what I'm actually doing is making what had been the subject, I'm giving it over to the world of the object. Right? Now you're all the object, but once this body is objectified, it's also the object. The sense organs that are the knower, pramanas, they're also objectified. Right? So then they become objectified, the objects. The mind also objectified, it becomes the object. The ahankara, the I notion, that also becomes the object. And once everything is objectified, then I have a different perspective. Then the sat-chit, the conscious being, that is me, is both the subject and the object. Just look at it like this. My eyes, I'm aware of my eyes, they're the object. But they're also, right, the subject. The eyes are the seer. But they're also objectified. So I take myself to be the subject and you to be the object. But actually, once this body, mind, sense organs becomes objectified, then I can say the sat-chit, the conscious being that I am, is not just the subject, looking at the object, I am the sat-chit which the subject and the object enjoys. You see, which this body-mind sense organs, the subject, it enjoys the sat-chit as well as the thing that is objectified. So this body-mind sense organs becomes enjoying sat-chit, conscious being, as well as everything else. Now, that is the reality. It's the reality of your experience, but the Dehatma Buddhi is so strong. This Anyonya Adhyasa, the superimposition, is so strong that we don't live with that experience. I don't have the, it's like the milk and the water. I don't have the viveka to differentiate conscious being from this conscious being from the totality of my experience, because I'm so used to identifying conscious being with this, in this form. I am the conscious being. Right? If you say, I am the conscious being, then that ahankara identifies the conscious being with this body, with this mind, with this sense organs. It doesn't recognize that conscious being, right, is both the subject and the object. That in fact there is nothing away from me, conscious being. So sometimes I just ask you, this doesn't work for everybody, but you can always try. Take your me, the me that you are, and just put it in the center of the room, like in the middle space. Just take your me and put it in the middle of the room. And just recognize everything as being, everything enjoying that me. And then does it or not? Put it in the middle of the room. You know, put the me in the middle of the room. And then you just ask yourself, is there anything away from me? It helps to break that identification. That identification is so strong. And what it says is like this jiva is totally asleep because of this beginningless maya, this anadi maya, this beginningless maya. The jiva is totally asleep because of that, because from the standpoint of the jiva, the antakarana, your mind, what makes you body, mind, sense organs, it's beginningless. The maya is beginningless. And what that jiva is made out of, the antakarana and the sukshma sharira, all of this, is beginningless. And when did it have it? What was its prior condition? Does maya have a prior condition? That antakarana has no prior condition for it to ever have known. It's never known. Always from its standpoint, it is enjoying conscious being, right? The conscious being, and looking at like the inert table and the inert space in your little pocket of conscious being walking around in this body, and this body can die, and so you're subject to birth and death. That is the legitimate experience based upon the limitations of the pramana, the means of knowledge available to you. And so what has to happen is, which is exactly what an Upanishad does with this guru-sisha relationship, the Upanishad, the Shastra, the teaching, what it has to do is come up, it's for the mind, the teaching itself is for the mind, to make the mind, the body, the sense organs, recognize their own objective stature. They're objects. They come into being and go out of being. They come into you and go out of you, into your being and go out of your being. Your being never does anything. Conscious being never does anything. It's never limited in any way. It never changes in any way. There is no experience that's away from it. No experience at all, ever, at any time. And so what about when the you, your me, gets liberated from the shackles of this body, mind, sense organs bondage, a bondage caused only by this anadi maya yasukta, this deep sleep, which is the natural condition of this maya, which is beginningless. So a person, when a person wakes up from that, and they wake as the Bhashya goes, how do they wake up from it? They wake up from it through pramana. That's what the whole Upanishad is about. They have to be woken up from it through teaching. Through teaching that brings about the mind's ability to differentiate itself. Self is only Maya also. Right? This Upanishad is going to move into this. The teaching is Maya. The teacher, the guru is Maya. Right? The teaching is Maya. The Upanishad is Maya. The Ajnanam itself is Maya. The whole problem, the bondage is Maya. The moksha is Maya. All duality is Maya. But the example that Shankara uses is, you know, you need a dream tiger to wake you up from the dream. You know? So the guru is like, the guru is like the dream tiger. The thing is that the one who's suffering is not you. It's not your being. You are always the same. You are changeless. You can't be harmed or injured in any way. You're ever the same. You're always whole and complete. That's your very swarupa. That's your very nature. The Atma has no problem. It has no limitation at all. But the mind does. It is the mind that is asleep because of beginningless ajnanam that is suffering. And it's suffering because even though your being is whole and complete and changeless, from the standpoint of the mind and the ajnanam, the mind from the mind's perspective, there is nothing more dear to you than you. You don't want to die, you know, and you want your ananda to be in place, right? That's what the mind wants. But what does the mind experience? Maya, the Maya mind, what does it experience? Continual change, continual birth and death, you know, continual loss of any experience of ananda, you know, birth, death, old age, sickness, disappointment, and trying to find a safe haven somewhere. Always trying to protect your being. You're a being that needs no protection, that is absolutely free. But Atma doesn't talk. Your being doesn't talk. It's the mind that's chattering away. Or the mind talks. Vocal cords talk. Your eyes see. All enjoying your being, and all at the same time enjoying their finitude. Their finitude, and their also their mityatva. And so the mind, the mitya mind, the maya mind, you know, is suffering. The self is not suffering at all. And so the dream tiger guru has to come and help the mitya mind discover its own mityatva. But it can't discover that mityatva, that state of being mitya, until it recognizes its own nature. Now, how can it recognize its own nature? The fact is that your own nature is already what we call aparoksha. Your nature is always present as you. So it's not really a matter of recognizing your own nature. It's through the teaching differentiating you, your being, from all of the things you had taken it to be, like here. The waker, the dreamer, the deep sleeper, and all of the conditions that each one of those states of experience enjoy. All of the finitude, all of the coming and going, all of the change, all of the limitation. We have to differentiate that from your own presence, which is self-evident. Now, by self-evident, this is the important key. Self-evident means I don't need my mind in order for me to be, for the self-experience to be there. I don't need a pramana. I don't need a means of knowledge for my being, for me to shine. Because the nature of me is conscious being. I don't need anything for that. If I get rid of the whole creation, I am. Without the words, the words that say I am, without the words, the very self-evident nature of me. That doesn't need any pramana. It doesn't need self-knowledge. What needs self-knowledge, what the self-knowledge is removing from this self-evident me all of the things that the mind has erroneously superimposed on it. And so that just requires teaching, you know. And it has to be taught in the same order of reality. The mithya mind needs a mithya guru and needs a mithya teaching to realize that the mithya bondage, that the bondage it's suffering is also mithya, and the moksha is also mithya. The moksha, the bondage and moksha are mithya, just maya, because to have liberation means you had a prior condition of being bound. You have to liberate you as though you weren't always liberated. So the bondage in moksha, guru, sisha, all of that is taking place within the maya creation. The Vedas also are mithya, everything. But this the mithya teaching, the mithya guru, and the mithya, that doesn't see that mithya guru is releasing the mithya sisha from the mithya bondage. Right. But in this order of reality, the mithya world, there is suffering, right? And what you recognize is that yourself is free. Yourself is not suffering. Yourself is whole and complete. It is the very ananda which the mithya world is running around trying to find. But looking outward, right, within duality, trying to find it within duality, because your sense organs, all of your sense organs, all of your means of knowledge, your hands, your feet, everything about the jiva is only meant to negotiate in the world and to fulfill your desires in the world, to find your ananda, to find your happiness in the world, to protect yourself so that you can exist a little bit longer, to gain knowledge so that you can know a little bit more. You want to know more and more and more because your being is knowledge. You know, you want to exist a little bit longer because your being is existence. You don't even know what death is. How could I possibly die? You can't conceive of it. You can conceive of losing the body because we know the body dies. And losing your sense organs and mind, but there is no possibility of conceiving or imagining non-existence. All you can imagine the absence of things. But in that imagination, that big blank, is only going to be filled by you. You can't, the one who is illumining the imagination or the conceptualization of non-existence is being itself. It's impossible to get there. It's absolutely impossible. And so what's happening is that the mind projects this nightmare. It's a nightmare of my demise or the loss of my being, because I experience the world losing being all the time. It comes into being and goes out of being. You experience nama rupa, name and form, losing being. You never experience the loss of being. You experience different objects coming and going in consciousness. You never experience the loss of consciousness, inertness. It's not possible. You can experience, this is another thing, you can experience the lack or loss of knowership, subject-object relationship, either in nirvikalpa samadhi, for instance, there's no subject-object relationship. In deep sleep, there's no subject-object relationship. But the conscious me, the self-evident me, is always there. There's never any movement there at all. We are also so conditioned to thinking of consciousness only in terms of consciousness of something. And that's why when we do japa and different types of meditation, what we realize is that me, the conscious self-evident me, is not doing anything to illuminate anything. I'm not knowing anything. Things are known. I'm not a knower. Things are known. There's a big difference. Like the sun is not shining on the earth to light it up. It's not performing an action. Because the sun is a luminary, everything in its wake is lit up. It's not doing anything. And I'm not doing anything. But everything that comes within the scope of a pramana, or the mind, that is lit up. And for Ishvara, whatever manifestation is there, that is lit up because it is conscious being. Even when we say it's lit up, it's not that consciousness is lighting it up. It's that consciousness is self-evident. And so when you think of the Satyam Mitya, there is no, for Ishvara, self-evident consciousness, the Maya, that Maya manifestation, is just a display of self-evident consciousness. It is all known because there is nothing that is not known. Knownness is the very swarupa, it's the very nature of consciousness. So the experience of the whole Ishvara Upadhi, it is known. Is numbness. The experience, every experience that you have, even though the antakarana is limited, but nevertheless, the satya mitya is still the same. And so every experience you have, it is known. There's nothing that's not known in terms of experience. And you think, well, I don't know this and I don't know that. But in fact, what you're thinking that you don't know, that is known. I don't know Chinese. Okay, that fact that you don't know Chinese, that's a vritti you're having. That I don't know Chinese. Okay, that I don't know Chinese word. That is known. There is nothing that's not known. The known is the very swarupa of the whole creation. So, when you differentiate, here it says, the sutta, when the jiva wakes up from this beginningless maya that takes place through the Upanishad, through the guru-sisha relationship, the next verse will go more into that, and he says, then what is the nature of this turiya? What is your nature? You know, after this differentiation takes place. It's then that the nature, my nature, is known. My nature is ajam. It's not subject to birth. There's no birth for me because there's no objectification. Anything that can be objectified existing within maya, right, has birth and death. Conscious being, which is timeless, has no birth and death. Anidram, for me there is no deep sleep. That's all within maya. There's no swapna. There's no this anyata grahanam. There's no identification with the universe or with the waking state, with the dream state. That belongs to maya. That doesn't belong to conscious being. And then advaitam. There's advaita because there's no second thing. Maya is not a second thing. What makes, when we say maya is mitya, that means it's not a second thing. Right? When we say clay pot, there's only clay. When we say rope snake, it's not like there's a snake to remove. There's only rope there. Maya is not a second thing. It has no being apart from the adhishtana. If everything that within duality fits into the category of maya, right, then there is no second thing. If time and space, if duality fits into the category of maya, right, or of mitya, then there's no duality. Just by the very fact that we bring the word mitya in. If something has been designated as mitya, it cannot contribute to duality. Because mitya depends on the adhishtana for its very being. Do you understand what I mean? Like, if this whole creation, everything that exists within time and space that comes into being and goes out of being, if upon analysis we can designate all of this as maya, and the order of reality of maya is mitya, then there's no second thing. There's nothing away from me. For there to be a second thing, I have to be able to give that thing a being, an existence that is other than me. Then there's a second thing. But if I can't do that, if I can't go into duality and say, well, there's me, I exist, and this also exists, then there's a second thing. But that there's this also exists, that's what can't be found. All we can find upon analysis is satchit. Everything else, every nama rupa, gets dismissed as mithya. So that's why he says, you know, when the jiva wakes up through teaching, then at that time what happens is I recognize myself as this, because I've differentiated myself, you know, from maya. Maya means mithya. What makes maya maya? Why does all of this get designated as maya? Because everything within duality comes into being and goes out of being. Right there, that's enough. Just that is enough.
Mm-hmm.
Because anything that comes into being and goes out of being is bordered by non-being. See what I mean? That's enough. It has to be understood, but if that's understood, it's enough, because there, first of all, there's no such thing as non-being. And so if something comes into being and goes out of being, what is there is being. Comes into being and goes out of being. What is there before, during, and after is only being. It has no other reality than that. Because if it's bordered by non-existence, right, it has to be totally dependent on something else for its being. Not on itself, because itself comes into being and goes out of being. The nama-rupa comes into being and goes out of being. Right? So it has no being. Because something that has no being on prior condition and posterior condition, if it has no being, has no being in the middle either. You see that? Has no being on this end, has no being on this end. You can't say in the middle it came into being. Because it can't come into being out of nothing. So that means whatever is there is dependent on something else for its being. And that whatever it's dependent on can't come into being and go out of being. So the bottom line is all that is left is being. And whose being is that? It's not anybody's being. It is being itself. And that being itself is me. Or I'm not. That's what it all amounts to. Either being is you, the satchit is you, or you're non-being. Either being or you're non-being. If you're non-being, you're not here. There's no. We don't even have to deal with you. You're non-being, so you're not here. But that isn't true. You're, the totality of your experience is me, is being, conscious being. And every experience that you have comes into conscious being and goes out of conscious being. Conscious being doesn't waver at all. But conscious being is ajam. It's always, it's free from birth. It is always the same. It's never asleep. It isn't dreaming. Sleep, dream, all of these states come into it and go out. You know, you have a dream, the dream comes into being, goes out of being. You have a life, this life comes into being, goes out of being. You have a thought, comes into being, goes out of being. What about being? Being is me. Everything comes into me and goes out of me. We have to take the word being, the satchit word, conscious being, it has to land on me. Now, for that to make sense, what we mean by me is the being that you are that is there present to every experience. Every experience. The worst and the best. All experience. All experiences that you have come into you and go out of you. Who is the you? Who is the me that is there? This personal me. When you meditate, you get rid of all experiences. I am there. Who is this personal me? That's the satchit. That is Brahman. That's what we're talking about. And so it's this changeless me that we have to wake up to, right, through this teaching. There it is. Two more verses in this sutta. Thank you.
Shate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishate Om Shanti 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 Harihi Om Shri Guru Pyo Namaha Harihi Om.
That are kind of unrelated. First, just to clarify, Ishvara is included in Maya.
Yeah.
So,
by included, though, we would say, like, more like this is a more proper way to say, Brahman with the Maya is what is Ishvara.
Mm-hmm.
And so, if we're looking at where we bring in Ishvara is when we're acknowledging this creation. This creation is Maya. But Maya is not away from Brahman.
Mm-hmm.
And so this creation is a conscious being. So when we're looking at just the reality, it's just Brahman, Satchitananda. But with Maya, we have Ishvara. See what I mean? So it's not that Ishvara is inside of Maya.
Right.
Yeah. Ishvara is Brahman with Maya.
So you would say Ishvara is beginningless, not...
Well, actually, when we're talking about, we'd say like this, Ishvara would be beginningless, but the truth of Ishvara is Brahman.
Mm-hmm.
So Brahman with Maya, which is beginningless, is Ishvara.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because Brahman, there's no parts to Brahman to go through any type of beginninglessness, where Maya is cyclical. And within Maya, it's always changing and coming into unmanifest condition, projecting, coming into unmanifest condition. So because there's change, we say beginningless.
Mm.
Like this creation, this is one of an infinite beginningless number of creations. No. But we're not going to say that Ishvara is beginningless. And he is beginningless if we look at it like that. But Ishvara is the self of the creation is Brahman. So Ishvara is really Brahman, you know, with the Maya Shakti. So yes, Ishvara is beginningless. Taking it from the standpoint of Maya.
Right.
Taking it
right.
from the standpoint of Brahman is free from time.
Right.
But from the standpoint of Maya, yeah.
And then my other question was, that last week you said that it sometimes is helpful to notice where, when you say I, where it lands.
Yeah, the ahankara.
And I was thinking, so if you say, I'm going to the store, and that is... And you notice that that lands on your mind, body, sense organs. But wouldn't that be correct?
It would be. That's when you're using, but only a jnani can have this differentiation. They talk about this in Panchadashi. Like if, say you have self-knowledge, and you're not going to say the body is going to the store. So you say, use the word I for, I'm going to the store. But you know what you're talking about.
Mm.
But say if you're thinking about yourself, just me, where your own being, where does it land? If you're an Ajnani, it'll land upon kind of the conscious body, mind, sense organs complex called Karya Karana Sangata. It means body, mind, complex. It just lands on me, this jiva here. But if you have knowledge, it lands on you, Brahman. You know, and then you can talk about your mind and your sense organs and all of that, but that's all mitya. You know what you mean by it.
Mm, okay.
Yeah. Makes sense?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So can you say like this, that this teaching is mitya by a mitya teacher and the knowledge takes place in the mitya mind?
Yeah. That's right. Mitya teacher, mitya mind, mitya bondage, mitya everything. Mitya Vedas. Mitya Upanishads, mitya teaching, but the mitya problem, you know, the whole problem, everything's mitya within duality. Brahman doesn't have a problem. So yeah, the whole, but the thing is that what to understand though in that, to really understand, the self, which is the truth of the whole thing, is self-evident. And so, and is the very being of the mind, for instance. And so the guru can teach the sishya, the student, to recognize, differentiate the mind from the self-evident I. And that self-evident I is not mitya. Right?
Yeah.
That's the only thing, but
yeah.
But it's since that's the set, but since it's the very self of the mitya guru can teach the mitya sishya to recognize its own being, which is self-evident. And so, and that self-evident being is not dependent upon mitya. It's like once the ajnanam is removed from that mind, right, then the self-evident nature of me is freed from the mind's mistake. The mind is freed from its own mistake. And then I just abide as I am. The mind's the one that was suffering. You understand? Because that can be a little tricky sometimes.
The whole thing is pretty trippy.
Trippy?
Remember when Swamiji at the beginning of the course and he took the word guru?
Oh, guru. Yeah, the one who removes darkness.
Yeah
the guru. I don't remember exactly.
He unfolded the...
Yeah, there's a beautiful verse for it.
Yeah.
I have
yeah,
that verse, actually.
The whole thing.
Yeah.
And then he says, and the darkness equates to...
Ajnanam.
And when you bring in a light, you remove that darkness to reveal what is, which is your true nature.
Exactly.
In other words, as you're saying, there's no attaining or attainment or anything like that, or a gain or anything. It's removing to reveal.
That's right. It's removing the ignorance that has caused you to superimpose a lot of problems upon yourself.
Right.
But it's not the experience of a new self. It's the recognizing that I am free. Yeah.
But there's a grief of the loss of the illusioned.
There's what?
I'm just kidding. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, when you realize something, you're kind of gaining the knowledge, but you're also this certain kind of letting go of the illusion that is also has a certain kind of... you know, there's a certain kind of letting go. It's, you know what I mean?
Well,
it's like on a, it's like maybe if you have invested a belief in a certain belief for 30 years, and then you realize that was really not the truth. You know, the, on one hand, it's like elevating because there's evolution taking place in your consciousness. On the other hand, it's also like a huge bummer because you realize you maybe wasted 30 years of investing in that illusion. So I'm just saying it's kind of, it's a really kind of shape-shifting, I would call it, that takes
what if you
place
think about,
in the soul in a certain way.
Yeah, but maybe this would help. But what if you think about you've wasted, if you're going to think in terms of waste, you've wasted beginningless lifetime until this moment. But I don't see it as a waste at all, really. You know, because this is a beautiful finale in a way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not a waste.
No, I'm not. Yeah, I'm not. Did I use the word waste?
I thought you did.
Yeah, that's what we heard.
Mm-hmm. Waste.
He wasted all this time. 30 years.
Yeah.
I didn't mean it really like waste in that way, but anyway, it's good.
I know, I mean, that's we do talk like that, but the thing is, once that, you get used to having knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
There are different kind of shocking things that you go through
mm-hmm.
initially. But you get used, it becomes normal, it becomes natural for you.
Well, why is it so hard for the mind to shift to this new way of thinking or new way of holding your identity?
Well, I think part of the problem is that the mind, what this might not be what you're talking about, but the mind is very invested in being itself,
mm-hmm.
you know, and so its own meanness, its own individuality is so wrapped up in this body-mind-sense organs that It doesn't want to, it feels it's going to have to give up its identity, which is not true. It's not true, because it's not like yourself ever was anything other than what it is, you know? And so actually the mind gets a tremendous amount of freedom and relaxation, because this upadhi is so held, totally held by the total, by the whole story, you know, and by yourself. Yourself is always there, totally 100% available to the mind. It's the very self of the mind. And so the mind has so much support, but it comes to this knowledge with a lot of notions.
But it's almost like the circuitry set up not to think the way the Shastra is talking.
That's true. The whole circuitry is to be part and parcel of the creation as a jiva.
Yeah.
You know, that's why we don't just say you're free, go, be happy. It takes some teaching, you know.
Yeah. Smile, be happy.
Smile, be happy, all's well.
Don't worry.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's it.
It's
don't worry, be happy.
Tying you, rewiring. It's kind of rewiring.
Yeah. It's a rewiring, but
that's part of the process also, it seems
it's
like.
It's all part of the process, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
That largely comes from listening to the teachings, but I'm just wondering, like, how helpful is it to do Nididhyasana?
I think Nididhyasana is very helpful, actually. But you have to, as you gain knowledge, then the more you gain knowledge, the more clarity, the more Nididhyasana is helpful, because it's giving your mind a chance to just be with the reality, to get used to it, to get used to yourself, to get used to develop that relationship.
And could you remind me, how do you do like a, I mean, you do the stuff we learned about taking care of the kids and, you know, getting the karma shuddhis, and then you would, like Dirk Drishya Viveka, that sort of, I'm not the body.
Well, you know, when we went through Dirk Drishya in the class, we went through those different types.
I missed yesterday.
No, not yesterday, before. The different types of meditation, the sabbikalpa.
Yeah, the four.
Yeah, that's some of it. But some of it, you know, like that shabda for samadhi, just using like, I am Brahman, or I am Ishwara. When these words mean something, or I am a sangha, or I am ananda. But those, you use those words to direct the mind to the fact. And so for those words to be meaningful, they have to mean something. Right, so say you've recognized yourself as Ishwara, to be able to say, I am Ishwara, and you really know what that means, or to be able to say, I am Brahman, or I am free. Now these words just, they direct the mind to the fact of it, and then allow your mind to, and you just use, it's like a mantra, you just use it to keep the mind
to notice.
Noticing that very thing. To
kind of redirecting it back.
Yeah, that's all. That's right.
Is it better not to do it until you're absolutely sure what those things
are? No, as long as you... No, that's not true. Because you start seeing it at the time of teaching. And so then you can sit, and then what you've understood at the time of teaching will start becoming more highlighted.
And yeah. Sometimes when I try and do these things, it seems like I'm banging my head against the wall. Like, you know, nothing's happening, I'm not getting it.
And when
is
that's,
it better to just say, forget it?
When that's the case, I would do things in the meditation that are more helpful. You know, like do the things that are helpful in the meditation, not things that are banging your head against the wall. The things that are banging your head against the wall, then that's something you bring to satsang or ask in class, and then we work on that. That means in that area there's some sort of vagueness, and that particular technique that you're using isn't helpful. It's not getting you anywhere. With meditation, really, every step of the way should be resolving your mind, helping to resolve the mind.
This kind of goes along with how it Nididhyasana becomes much more helpful the more you actually have understanding.
Yeah, and the more that you have worked on the little children inside also. Mm. That's a real thing, because otherwise there's like an emotional bypass,
mm-hmm.
and you're trying to have this profound meditation, but all the little ones are mm-hmm. saying, you're not paying attention to me, and I don't want to meditate. I want you to be with me. And so that taking care of all of the different parts inside needs to become kind of second nature, to where that's something that you just do that. So, because otherwise the unconscious doesn't really want to meditate, because it isn't being taken care of. You know, so that's another very real. So it can be like we can say, oh, that's an obstruction. But to me, I would never say to my child or my Tibby, you're an obstruction. You know, it's not about being an obstruction. They need some love and understanding and care.
When that's the case, doesn't it usually show up as like maybe a lot of thought or emotion?
Yeah. And then how to just be with that. Not try to bypass that, to be with that as a really good parent, the parent you wish you would have had.
mm-hmm.
Or not that we didn't have good parents, but all parents are not good enough. No parent is good enough.
It's a reparenting kind of thing.
Yeah, it is a reparenting. It's a reparenting.
And that's fundamentally just really about validation, right? That parenting.
It is validation.
Yeah. I mean, at the core of that parenting is validation, right?
I think so. It's a lot of love and respect.
Yeah.
And giving the benefit of the doubt. See, if when you love somebody and you respect them, you give them the benefit of the doubt that they really are a good person. And you are a good person, and you're really trying. And if you make this mistake or that mistake, then that's okay. And we just work on making that better. It's not, you know, this type of critical thing.
Mm-hmm.
If that criticalness is there, then you're not giving the benefit of the doubt.
Mm-hmm.
You're giving the benefit of the doubt when you're trying to help. You know, it's just, we have these notions that we're supposed to be perfect or better, but we can be better, but then we work to become better. It's just like, say, if you're studying the piano, for instance, you're doing the scales, and you do the scales over and over and over again, you're working to become better, to become more adept at that. It's the same with gaining all the beautiful qualities. You work on those, and then you respect yourself for working on those, and you're happy rather than critical. Makes all the difference in the kind of the internal landscape. But you're trying, you're doing your best. You're not supposed to be a maestro, you know, right away. It takes time.
I was thinking about lately, I've been thinking about silence. I had this thought the other day about the Mandukya and how important silence is in like all spiritual traditions, and how important it is in meditation. And that it somehow like reflects a quality of Atma, like it. There's something similar about it, and that's why it's used as a metaphor, because things come into it and then
that's
go out of it.
And also because the self, yourself, is silent, right?
Mm-hmm.
We always compare silence to sound, but your being is the silent conscious being that illumines silence and sound, right? And so silence is, even if your mind is thinking or there's noise going out outside, underneath it you are silent. And so you can always recognize the silence in the sound, the silence that is there holding your chattering mind.
Always. Well, that silence almost is like a mirror. You can look at silence and realize that my being is silent.
Yeah, the silence that is available to sound and silence, the silence behind the sound and silence, behind that duality, That silence is the silence of the self. You know? And that's always present. So you can always get to yourself that way.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because you're not making any noise. So all noise, all duality, all thoughts, all feelings, all moods, all emotions are taking place in the silent presence, being of yourself.
And why is that being silent?
Well, because otherwise it would be in duality, right? It would be mitya. Non-dual is silent. So the thing is, what's beautiful about it is you can always recognize the pervasive, silent being of yourself amidst all of the chatter, all of the noise. So the noise doesn't disturb the silence. The thoughts and the emotions don't disturb the silence. The viveka is, what you need there is just the viveka. Yeah.
But the actual silence helps sometimes.
It does. It does until you don't need that help. But it does help because it gives your mind a chance, which is so used to just identifying with the noise. It gives it a chance to come into real relationship with that silence. So it learns kind of how to dive into it, how to rest in it. And Nididhyasana is very helpful for that, you know, because the mind is used to being continually engaged in an activity. Yeah.
Change.
Nididhyasana is, and if you, it's a wonderful practice. You can do it, have that practice every day, and you don't want to spoil it by trying to say, oh, I have to meditate for an hour or a half an hour. You just do it for however long you do it. Because otherwise, you know, you'll get into this thing where, yeah, I don't really have time. Mm-hmm. You do have time. You have 30 seconds.
Or 5 seconds.
Or 5 seconds, or a minute. It's only when you put all these restrictions on it, then you think, well, I can't do it. But otherwise, it's just become something that you can, and you don't have to, you can have your own altar and your own asana, you know, a place where you go, but you can also do it when you're just sitting in a chair. You can do it when you're taking a walk. So you have to take all the restrictions off it. And then you can enjoy sitting in your own asana when you have time, or enjoy taking a walk and just resolving, you know.
Well,
it just becomes a natural part of your life.
Well, does it count to just be able to say, I'm free,
and just
leave it at that and see the truth of it for that nanosecond even? You know?
Yeah. And say if you say, I'm free, those words have to mean something to you. Those are meaningful words. You know what you mean. Then those words are meaningful. That just takes you to the fact of it.
Mm.
Yeah.
And so pretty much shabda is the way to do it?
Well,
once you've done the inner child thing.
Shabda, that's one of the ways, but you know, like we were doing in the Drik Drisha,
uh-huh.
You know, just also when you're taking a walk, recognizing your own presence amidst all of the experience, the totality of the experience that you're having, in reference to your mind, the thoughts that you're having, recognizing the silent, your silent preference, presence in reference to the thoughts or emotions that you're having. There you're not really using shabda, you're using viveka, to differentiate your own presence from the experiences that you're having. The difference is when you're using shabda, like you're saying, I am free, or I am a sanghoham, or whatever, then what's happening is you're using those words to direct the mind toward you, toward your own being. So you're resolving the mind into your own being. In the others, where you're using just the experience, sensory perception, or thoughts that are going through your mind, there you're using the viveka. You're just recognizing the changelessness of your own presence in reference to the emotional or mental experiences they're passing through, or in reference to the sensory perceptions. So all of those are useful.
Yeah.
It's not that, you know, I mean, if you're taking a walk, you can recognize that. If you're thinking about something or feeling something, you can recognize that.
Mm.
You can direct your mind through shabda just to resolve into yourself. So there are different ways.
Whenever I do the viveka part of it, it seems like I just get into a neti-neti thing. And I wonder if I'm doing it wrong.
No, when you're going into a neti neti.
It's basically like, okay, if I recognize something, it's an object, and it's not me. And then it happens again and again and again. That's what I mean by getting into a neti neti.
That's more of a neti neti neti, I'm not this, I'm not that. That's the drik drisha. So you're seeing, differentiating. That's fine as long as it's landing. That's helpful for you to recognize your own presence.
How would you do Viveka differently than that?
I would.
If you wanted to.
Yeah. That would be helpful. You could, say you're just objectifying your body, and then you go back and forth from the standpoint of your body just to your own presence. Then you recognize your own, the me, your presence, and then the physical body, and then the conscious being who is indwelling the physical body, then the physical body. Then you go to the mind. You recognize the mind. And then you go back and forth, the mind to your own presence, the me, that is the self of the mind. The mind, then just to you, then the mind to you. So you get used to making that differentiation. You can even, and then if you want to, after you've done that in reference to the body, the sense organs, say in reference to the mind, and then you can, after you've done that, then you can just put more emphasis on just your own presence and let the mind and the body be. Let them just be what they are, but your more focus is just on your own presence.
It sounds almost like a musician starting out by playing scales and exercises and eventually graduating to actual music.
Well, maybe in a way, because at first you're not so used to making that differentiation. And then after some time, there's never a time when you don't make that differentiation because you're used to it. The mind starting out is not used to that at all, doesn't even know about it. From the mind standpoint, I am. Whatever the thought is, that's me at the moment. There's no differentiation between my own presence and thought.
Well, that sounds like a kind of a busy experience to notice both simultaneously.
It can be busy, or you can do it slowly. You don't have to view it as being busy.
Well, are both events going on at the same time?
They are. That's why it doesn't really matter in the end whether you're thinking or feeling or having emotions, because you're always there. That's the satya mitya. Mm-hmm. Nothing's ever happening to you. You're always exactly the same. And so we do sometimes these exercises just for the mind to get used to that. Mm-hmm. Probably the best thing, though, to do is for me to do more guided meditations around this. I'll start doing them again.
Oh, that would be nice.
Because when it's guided, then you take whatever the guided meditation is and then you do it on your own and make it yours. Like your timing might be a little different, or the way you do it might just be more tailored to what works best for you, but you have experience it in class. We'll do it. Shall we stop there?
Yay!
I'm going to meet with somebody now.